Welcome to this season of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. I'm Professor Belinda Lennox. I'm a psychiatrist and a researcher here in Oxford. And this season, you'll be joining me as we demystify the science behind the most complex object in the known universe, our brains, and look at the wide-reaching impacts of mental illness on individuals and society. I'll be introducing you to some of Oxford's best academic minds working to solve the greatest challenges in brain and mental health. And I'll also be speaking to guests from beyond the university to bring their perspectives and lived experience and get a sense of the impact of what we're doing. Join us as we discover how Oxford is shaping the future of brain and mental health research. Welcome to another episode of Future Makers. This is the second of two conversations that we're having about mental health in the workplace. And I'm really delighted to be joined by Professor Jan-Emmanuel Deneuve, who is the director of the Wellbeing Research Centre and fellow at Harris Manchester College in Oxford and professor of economics and behavioural science at the Said Business School. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you.
So this is a wide-ranging topic, and it's of high priority to a lot of people listening, I should think, because well-being in the workplace, as our discussion with Sir John Kerwin, is of prime importance for individuals' well-being, but also for business performances. Maybe do you want to start by highlighting some of your recent research around the importance of the area?
Thank you first and foremost for inviting me to the podcast and to raise the profile of workplace well-being and mental health, because it couldn't be more important. And I think the first point to make is obviously the fact that we spend so much time at work, probably about, on average, about 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And so it goes without saying that that feeds into our general life satisfaction. So the way we feel at work very much feeds into it. It's not like we leave our well-being at the door as we walk out, or our general well-being at the door as we walk into the office. And so there's a strong connection between job satisfaction and life satisfaction, if you will, empirically. The other reason why work is so important, and maybe it's a good place to start, is it's work is an important part of our identity, builds networks, builds a routine throughout the week, which we do need from time to time, and also is a source of lifelong learning. And so we find that people without work and are looking for it are about 1 point less happy, about on a scale from 0 to 10. So the average Brit has about a 7 out of 10 in terms of life satisfaction, or just below that to be more precise. And if we split the population to those that have work and those that do not but would like, we see there's a whole point difference in their life satisfaction, which is actually quite a lot. Very few things have that much impact on people's general well-being as, say, being made redundant, losing your work has, because precisely the reasons I mentioned, you lose identity, you lose social ties, routine throughout the week, etc. So work is incredibly important for well-being generally. And those people at work, we should do the very best possible to make them, build an environment around workers that makes them thrive and flourish.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, work is really important for your well-being, but I'm assuming that, well, maybe I'm just looking at it from a negative point of view, working in the NHS, that the workplace can also harm your well-being quite significantly. There was a recent report by the Nuffield Trust showing that the second most common reason for leaving health and social care is burnout and stress and lack of well-being.
And we pick some of that up in our big crowdsourced data sets. So especially here, the NHS, and even locally, the Oxfordshire NHS Trust, we find that stress levels have been going up, job satisfaction and workplace happiness has come down. The only thing that's sort of above average still is a sense of purpose at work. And people, if you know just how much effort and how important the work is that nurses and the medical teams are doing, you kind of realize just how much purpose there is in their work. But it's one of these rare instances in the data where well-being items, the well-being outcomes of happiness, satisfaction, sense of purpose, and the absence of negative stress, normally they tend to go hand in hand. And the NHS is one of those cases where you see people still sort of relying on a bank of doing good for the rest of the world and a high sense of purpose, despite all the other indicators of well-being coming down gradually.
Yeah.
So a lot needs to be done on that, especially in those circumstances, to improve workplace well-being.
So I know you've done a lot of detailed work recently, exploring the sort of measures of workplace well-being and the sort of drivers behind it. Do you want to describe that to us?
Yes, I'd be pleased to. So first of all, conceptually, we make a strong distinction between outcome measures and driver measures, so the inputs and the outputs. The output of workplace well-being is how you feel. If it was general well-being, how you feel about life. In the case of work, how you feel about your job or how you experience work. And we typically look at more affective measures, which are how you experience work. Are you experiencing positive emotions or negative emotions at work? Or how you think about work, which is more evaluative. So that would then be how satisfied are you with your job, which you take a step back and you reflect on whether you like what you're doing. So, or a sense of purpose is also an evaluative measure. And so we think about these kind of measures as the ultimate outcome, the key performance indicator for well-being. But those are not to be confused with what drives it, what explains why or how you feel the way you do, which would be whether you're being paid fairly or not, whether you've got a supportive line manager or not, whether you've got the flexibility to strike a good work-life balance, whether you've got a sense of belonging and trust your colleagues, etc. So we also pulse all of those items, and in the big crowdsourced survey that I'm sure we'll get to talk about, we do about 10 of these driver items. But it's important, I think, and I cannot repeat this enough, to conceptually distinguish between inputs and outputs. Because if you do that, then everything downstream in terms of the analyses starts making a lot more sense and the piece of the puzzle come together. If, however, as I see often happen, people sort of mix and match different types of items, so I'll put job satisfaction next to work-life balance to a supportive manager, then in the end you end up with some kind of index or score that confuses inputs and outputs. And then when an HR manager needs to think about, well, where should I invest in, then they don't have much guidance to go on. Yeah. If it's just an index or a dashboard with all kinds of things going up and down.
Yeah, because I suppose there's less direct material for any kind of manager to get hold of, levers that they can actually influence on change themselves. Actually, if things are out of their control, then, you know, so what kind of thing?
True. But also, if you make that conceptual distinction, then it allows you to run driver analysis, or in academic speak, simply a regression, with something on the left-hand side of the equation, which would in this case be the KPI or outcome measure of job satisfaction. And then you can look to see what is the relative importance of being paid fairly, supportive managers, sense of belonging, work-life balance in driving job satisfaction. Yeah. And once you do those kind of analysis, it then allows you or enables you to get a sense for what is the relative importance and where should I invest my typically limited resources. Because if you do it the old-fashioned way and just have a dashboard or everything sort of mixed together, then you would, and you have, say, a million, say you're a big company or the University of Oxford, and you want to spend a million on trying to improve well-being. Where do you start? And in a typical dashboard approach, you wouldn't have any empirical clue or evidence base. You would probably spend your million equally spread across, say, 10 qualitative elements of work. But the reality might be that some things are more important for your workers than others. And if you are unable to run a regression or that driver analysis following that conceptual split, you'll never know where to put your money. And some things are more important. And we find that actually to be the case. So if I were to ask our audience, out of sort of 10 qualitative dimensions of work, from fair pay to a sense of belonging to work-life balance to learning on a job, etc., which ones do you think is most important to you? Then typically people will say flexibility and being paid fairly. But when you actually run the analysis to see what is most strongly correlated with actual job satisfaction, it turns out that pay is important, but it falls to the middle of the pack. And the thing that stands out is sense of belonging. Having positive social relations on the job is a lot more important than people think it is. But we can only pick up on these kind of things by actually looking at what is their job satisfaction and then seeing how that is predicted by a number of drivers. And so, for example, if you just do a traditional index or a dashboard approach, you wouldn't have picked up that investing in a sense of belonging, improving workplace culture, making sure the space for people to connect as humans between them and to treat them right could actually be a bigger impact on your workplace well-being than adding more money on a specific other driver that you thought was most important but couldn't actually gauge.
That's so interesting. Again, I'm thinking back to the health service just because that's the area I know, and there've been a big push on well-being, particularly for junior doctors. And what it means in practice is that you might get a few beanbags in a rest area and a microwave or something, whereas actually their sense of belonging, inclusion, respect at work, you know, maybe more difficult to implement and measure perhaps, but far more important for their retention really and happiness at work.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And I agree with you. Belonging is a bit of a difficult concept to sort of nail and see, well, what can we actually do? But when we unpacked it a little bit, and actually we did ask a lot of people, so what does it mean to you, belonging? And we sort of come up with the thing that stood out was like, we want it to be treated like human beings.
Yeah.
We want to have like friends at work is a good example. Knowing what you represent within the organization, how you impact others in the organization, turn out to be a way of getting a sense of belonging, whether you feel a sense of belonging, and social elements and social events. And so that's really important to people. And that's also why they stay. So retention rates are very much dependent on this. Give you a classic example in the field, Gallup, the extraordinary global pollster and survey expert. They have something called the Gallup Q12 Engagement Survey, which many, many thousands and thousands of organizational units have applied. And there's one item in the Q12, which is, do you have a friend at work? And I remember vividly the CEO of Gallup telling me, Jan, guess which one of the Q12 items is most predictive of people staying? And it was having a friend at work.
The most predictive?
Of job satisfaction or retention was actually the social item.
Yeah.
And I bet that if you'd ask people to rank order what they think is most important, it would have been the pay or something else or flexibility. But really, it's the social elements that bring us job satisfaction. Obviously, it's not the only thing, but it's a lot more important than people expect it to be. And I've now found it across multiple data sets every time and over again. You see these sort of social elements, sense of belonging, positive social relationships. I mean, in HR, there's an old saying, people don't quit their jobs, they leave their bosses.
Yeah.
And so the social relationships, the quality of them, and especially with the line manager, it's absolutely critical for job satisfaction, people staying put.
Yeah. So retention is obviously a really important aspect, but from a business point of view, I suppose productivity and actually doing whatever business they do better than competitors is equally, or you know, maybe even more important. What's the link between well-being and productivity?
Oh boy, there's a lot of work that I can speak about. And so there's two big studies. One is at the individual level, so employee well-being and their individual productivity and performance. And I should dig into that now. And then we can level it up to the organization and see whether there's an actual business case for investing in workplace well-being and how that relates to business performance. So let's start at the individual level. I'm really proud, really. So we had a paper published in Management Science, which is frankly the top journal in business studies. And it was published about 3 months ago. But it took us about 7 years to really get to the bottom of this and get it out there with Management Science. And it's in collaboration with British Telecom. And it's really digging into, in a way never seen before, into that question, an old question of, is a happy worker a more productive worker? And while it's very intuitive to most people, and it makes a lot of sense, and a lot of people already act upon it, luckily, but it's very difficult to prove causally. Because if I'm feeling happy, I might be a better worker or more performing, but my happiness could have derived from being successful at work in the first place, or having a good day at work one way or another could feed back into my well-being. So how do you disentangle this chicken and egg problem, or causality, reverse causality issue, or endogeneity issue, as the economists would call it? And the way we've done it is, at BT, there's about 12 major call centres spread around the UK, from the north to the south, all the way down the country. And we pulsed these call centre employees every week on Thursday at 4 or 5 p.m., if I'm not mistaken, to say, how happy are you feeling this week? And we did this for a whole long period, all of the call centre workers. And so we had a good sense for how they felt from 1 week to another, so that's great. we were then able to link that to all of their performance data. And it's almost scary the extent to which there's granular performance data about these individuals. It is number of seconds per call, how many calls they do, customer satisfaction coming back, all at the individual level, weekly sales at the individual level, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was, I think, in and of itself, an extraordinary data set for the first time, combining weekly measures of how one feels with weekly measures of detailed measures of performance. But that wasn't good enough as of yet to claim causality, because we found a strong correlation there, but that was still correlation. The way we got at causality is a bit of a long story, but stick with me. We used the different weather patterns around each one of the call centers. And so the weather in Britain is typically not great, but there's still a lot of variation between it from the south to the north. And we looked at these weather patterns around each call center as people would come in that week. And that still wasn't sufficient as a shock on people's well-being, and then see how those variations due to the weather would influence their productivity. We had to interact that with the exposure they had to the weather inside the call centers. As it turned out, some call centers were full glass and others were no glass windows at all. And so what we did is we interacted essentially the weather that day with the exposure to the weather by call center, to see how that influenced people's well-being. And yes, lo and behold, how the weather is today and the exposure you have to it influences your mood. And we picked up that, which is point one. And point two, that changed and had an impact on your productivity. And it wasn't because of clients, because the clients were calling in from around the UK, not locally. And so that's how we were, for the first time, I think, able to nail a causal estimate in a field setting at a scale never seen before. And it's really exciting. And I'll just, the headline result was essentially when workers were feeling the equivalent of 1 point better from 1 week to another on a scale from 0 to 10, that meant that they would be selling more. Their weekly sales would be 12% up that week. So they sold about 23 items a week, and they would then now sell about, what is it? I think it was about 26 items a week on average.
Wow.
So it's really quite something.
So you can see these changes within result, within individuals, basically.
Immediately.
The sun is shining, they feel happier, and they're more productive.
Yeah. Now, it's the study really is about trying to see if you feel better, how does that relate to then being more performant on your job? Mm. Whether, like, we really,
yeah.
A lot of people in the media were like, oh, so it means that you have to move people to the south because there's more sun.
Yeah.
It's really, that was, we sort of leveraged or used the natural experiment of the weather differences and the exposure to it. One thing I want to dig into a little bit, which is the general effect, the average treatment effect, if you will, was about 12% on people's productivity. But there was quite a lot of variation in how well-being mattered by type of work they were doing. So we classify their work into sort of three types. And the first one was really just order taking. And the honest truth is, if it was the most simple, most basic of tasks, order taking when customers called in, how you felt that week didn't have much impact, in fact, no impact on your performance and order taking. However, when the tasks were more complex and required social and emotional intelligence, such as retaining a disgruntled customer or selling a more complex package of products, then we saw that the effect of how you felt that week was a lot more than 12%. Mm. So 12% was just the average across all types of tasks. And so there's an important message here, I think, which is that for all jobs, and most jobs are obviously reliant on your social and emotional skills, how you feel really heightens your social and emotional intelligence, which makes you relate to other people a lot better and do a lot better in whatever kind of job you're doing. And given that the future of work is very much moving in the direction of the work that we can't give over to machines or AI, it's probably the ones that are mostly reliant on social and emotional intelligence, workplace well-being will become increasingly important.
Did you find that actually the environment that people were working in had an impact as well? You're saying that some people had offices with a lot of natural daylight, some people with no windows at all. Did that have an influence?
It's interesting because it's not something that we set out to study, but because we had to leverage these variations in the architecture and the weather and in turn the exposure to the weather, we sort of got into it. I think it seems to matter a lot, but it can cut both ways. So if the weather is bad outside and it's raining and miserable and grey outside, then having a lot of exposure to it was not helpful. Yeah. If the weather is nice outside, then exposure to it was helpful for well-being. Yeah. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. It's hard. The paper we don't come out with a statement on the impact of sort of natural light, although I think there is now some evidence, but not by us, around the fact that seeing green and natural light is, needless to say, an important element of a good workplace.
Yeah, I was thinking more broadly, perhaps, whether there's anything about, workplaces. You know, there's a lot of focus now about, beautiful architecture, or whether open plan working, or whether, just the setting that people work, whether actually that has a significant impact. I don't know whether there's anything.
So there's the architecture and access to natural light. I'm more interested in a way the architecture of the social connections. Mm. So what is the best sort of office setup to allow you to work privately and when you have to concentrate on specific tasks that don't require connecting with others. And then you also want places and spaces that are really nudging people towards connecting with each other and brainstorming, exchanging ideas and connecting on a human level to generate that sense of belonging. I haven't thought much about it, but I'm sure that you could look at sort of like platforms in office buildings that are conducive for people connecting and generating a sense of belonging, and others that aren't.
Hello, I hope you're enjoying this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. If you'd like to learn more about our work here in Oxford, head to ox.ac.uk/brain or let us know what you think on social media using the hashtag OxfordBrain.
I want to dig into something else. We've now just been speaking about the individual level. So even if I've told you just now that in the BT study, we've been able to nail causally that improving feeling better by a point on a scale from 0 to 10 led these call center employees to be 12% more productive, that still doesn't prove a business case. Because while we should all invest in workplace well-being for the obvious reasons, it might still be very costly for BT to invest in somehow improving telesales workers a point on a scale from 0 to 10, because it's not that easy to improve people by as much. And so maybe cost them more than 12% gain in productivity. So for the very difficult, reticent sort of chief financial officers and chief execs that we are still dealing with, because a lot of people are talking the talk but not necessarily walking the walk on workplace well-being, we still had to show a business case. And so I'm very keen to speak a bit more about what is now essentially the world's largest study in employee well-being, and that has allowed us and enabled us to do and prove the business case.
Amazing. Yeah, well, exactly. So what do you know about cost-effective interventions that businesses can implement?
Mm-hmm. Well, before getting into the interventions, it's what we've been able to show is that when you link average workplace well-being at companies, and in a comparable way with all other major companies, we found most recently, and it got a lot of media attention, that links up with their financial performance. Mm. And so whatever the companies do, whatever interventions they do to improve workplace well-being, it seems to pay off. So whatever it costs, whatever they do, there is a strong positive correlation between a higher level of workplace well-being in your organization and financial performance, whether it's measured through return on assets, gross profitability, or Tobin's Q, which is the fancy finance word for essentially firm value or book value. And so that's really exciting. And so I think we've, in that work, we've now actually kind of shown the business case that there is a strong case for investing in workplace well-being, because those companies that do and are successful in raising workplace well-being do better. And the reasons are to do with individual productivity. So if people feel on average better one week than another, they'll perform better. But it's also become a more attractive employer, attracting talent. And we mentioned it earlier on in our chat, people also are retained for longer. Mm. So retention stays longer. And anybody working in human resources knows that retaining your talent longer is a real money saver, cost saver in the mid to long run. So there's a lot of reasons why one should invest. Now, what got a lot of attention is not just our business case material, but also the investor case that we then made, because the same underlying data which we crowdsource through the platform called Indeed, which is the world's largest job search platform. And we now have about 17 million people, I kid you not, who've responded to our survey, essentially reviewing their employers and how they feel in these workplaces, mostly the US, but also UK, Canada, and other markets. Well, we've been able to tie this to the stock market performance of companies as well, to see whether a portfolio, just based on how people feel in companies, might be predictive of how these companies then perform the subsequent year, and whether they outperform classic indices such as, you know, S&P 500 or the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ average. And lo and behold, they do. So we started this in 2019 and 2020, and the 2019-2020 data, investing based just on what the best places to work for, would have you outperform the stock market in 2021. And using the 2021 data, you would have outperformed the stock market in 2022. And using the 2022 data, you would have outperformed so far in 2023. And so that's really exciting. So I think we've got both the C-suite and the companies, but also the investors and the rating agencies all sort of coming along saying, wait a second, these intangible, subjective well-being data seem to have very strong objective consequences, including for the bottom line. And so I think there's increasing interest in it. And my hope is that it will lead to positive interventions.
Yeah, absolutely. So does it, I suppose that's the next question. Does it therefore point to the finance directors and to the chief executives to saying, actually, we really need to improve our productivity and our stock exchange value, and these are the evidence-based ways in which we can do that?
Yeah, so I do think there's now a real interest in this. The problem I see is that organizations individually don't have necessarily a good sense of what actually works.
Yeah.
And up until recently, they sort of went through they went for more wellness type interventions, such as yoga and other types of sessions, or giving you access to an app of some kind, providing mindfulness classes, what have you. But really, I think they've now realized that those things are interesting and don't hurt and are always welcome. But they need to think more structurally. Mm. It's the corporate culture, generating more of a sense of belonging, improving people's pay, flexibility, working from home and finding the right hybrid mode that works for their organization, their people. It's workplace well-being sits well beyond just HR. It sits across from the CEO who sits at the top of a certain corporate culture, to the CFO who needs to make sure people are paid properly, to the CHRO who needs to work on the other types of practices. So it's a lot more serious and more structured. The problem, however, is they don't quite know where to start, because they'll all have some ideas. They will have seen a friend or a colleague do something that seemed to have worked. But there's no sort of menu of interventions out there. Okay. Not yet. We're working on it. But not as of yet a full-blown menu of interventions that they can sort of pick from and then adapt in function of their own sort of data to see where should we invest most, which interventions have worked the best. But it's been essentially up to us we've seen that need in the field out there and amongst the big organizations. And we're going to try and supply and do something about it. And so we've literally, over the past 6 months, have put together a team, and we've been surveying all the literature, all the academic literature that has evaluated and assessed workplace interventions that have improved workplace well-being or drivers of workplace well-being. And we've rank ordered all of that evidence in function of the strength of the evidence and the impact it had. And together with a whole group of corporates who are backing us in this effort, and that collective is called the World Wellbeing Movement, and it includes the likes of Unilever and HSBC and BT and Indeed and S&P Global. They've all given us a bit of money to put resources together to build out a number of things, including a menu of interventions that could then become a public good. So we're working really hard on building out a tool that will be made available for people to be inspired and know that these kind of interventions are the ones that are most likely to move the needle on workplace well-being or workplace well-being drivers. And if they then match it to their own data to see where there's the highest needs for interventions, at least we'll move towards more of an evidence-based approach to improving workplace well-being. If versus the very gut-based approach that is currently the case.
But I completely hear what you're saying. It's not an add-on. It's not something to give to a well-being officer to think about the lunchtime activities. This is core to the fabric of an organisation and the culture of the place, isn't it?
Exactly.
I'm also wondering whether it's a bit like sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that if you don't have people on secure job contracts and people that are paid a minimum living wage, then actually thinking about, you know, other aspects is a little bit, you know, superfluous.
Exactly. Or offering yoga classes outside office hours, dragging people into the place they don't like for even longer, is not something that is all that conducive to workplace well-being.
Yeah. Okay. I suppose I really want to ask you about the World Happiness Report, because I mean, it gets such a lot of press and a lot of interest every year, with people, you know, ranking the Scandinavian countries as being much better than the UK to live in, for instance. Does it say anything about workplace well-being and workplace culture, perhaps, as being part of the reasons why some of these places are better places?
Interesting. That's a really good question. So as one of the editors of the World Happiness Report, we've been producing this now for 11 years in a row. Always comes out March 20th, which is International Day of Happiness, so fits well. The focus has really been on populations. And it's not, again, just to also repeat to an issue we've talked about right at the beginning, it's not an index. It's literally just the raw numbers of self-reported life evaluations or life satisfaction coming back from populations, and those are surveyed through the Gallup World Poll. So thanks again to our friends at Gallup for enabling the report and providing the data. We had in the past, we've had two chapters that dug into workplace well-being, trying to get a sense for what is the importance of work around the world. So is the and one of the things we found is that, needless to say, that work is incredibly important for everyone around the world. So whether you're in Europe or the US or Asia or Latin America, having a job versus not having a job was a huge difference. It was actually slightly bigger for the for men than for women, which I've always found interesting. But it's an interesting and complex subject. We also found average levels of, for those people lucky enough to have a job, the average levels of job satisfaction and by type of industry, and how does that differ between regions around the world. So we found that in Australia, New Zealand, and North America, farmers were actually, people working in agriculture were actually happier than average in those contexts. But that was not the case in, say, Asia or Africa.
Oh.
And so things that once you start thinking about actually kind of make a lot of sense. But it was nice in the World Happiness Report context to put these very macro numbers out there in terms of the importance of work, depending on which context and which region you're living in, the importance of specific industries and how that might differ between some regional world regions versus others. So there's a lot there. To your question of what explains differences in population well-being and the reason why the Scandinavians do so well, we typically talk about social capital, the welfare state, social trust. Workplace has never been much of it's not a specific item that we normally use to explain variation between countries, but it's sort of the other items feed through. So the fact that in Scandinavia there's a great welfare state and a lot of social trust, and will likely, although I don't have evidence for this, but will likely feed through into the workplace where there's higher levels of trust and belonging to begin with. Because in those contexts there's also less hours being worked, there's better work-life balance to begin with. And so, yeah, there's a number of elements that will probably that help explain the variation between the Scandinavians that tend to do so well on life evaluations versus other countries, and that what makes those populations happier will also be partially due not just to societal but also workplace elements that are similar in nature to the ones that you'd find in society at large or the welfare state.
Yeah, there's lots of interesting differences. I remember visiting colleagues in Norway, where, and I was surprised to hear that basically, if you don't take your annual leave, you're basically marched out of the building and forced to go on holiday, which I quite like the idea of that. But also, you know, the discussion at the moment about working an 11-month year, for instance, or working the 4-day week. But in Scandinavia, actually, you know, that's pretty normal.
Yeah. And interestingly, their productivity levels on the hourly basis are a lot higher than ours. So they work less. I think it's in the US and UK, it's about 1500 hours worked a year, something like that. In Scandinavia, maybe more like 1200. And so if you then look at sort of GDP, which is my favorite measure, but if you then split it by the number of hours worked, you'd find that they are a hell of a lot more productive on an hourly or daily basis. And so there's something about reducing pressures, improving well-being, which in turn releases that productivity level. So for example, going back to the BT study, one way society can help call center employees be happier 1 point on a scale from 0 to 10, may not be due to BT, but it could be moving to a 4-day week, for example, would move their average well-being of a BT call center from, say, 6 to 7. Yeah. BT would gain as a result from that. And so while we'd be working a day less, which would hit overall output, it wouldn't be the equivalent of a whole day out of 5. It wouldn't be, 20% less. It might be a lot less. It might be because the better work-life balance, improvements in well-being might release greater productivity in turn. So we might, in some cases, you might even see full compensation for the working a day less might be compensated fully by being more productive in the days you do work. So it's interesting. So they've gotten that balance better, I think. And to your example of having to take up your holidays, otherwise, you're being frowned upon. It's the exact opposite in the United States.
Completely.
And that is a real, real problem. And that culture is devastating for well-being and work-life balance. And you can kind of tell,
yes,
in our data.
Jan, thank you for a fascinating discussion about the world of workplace well-being. And I really look forward to seeing what you come up with next.
Thank you. I do too.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. You can find more episodes of Future Makers wherever you get your podcasts and more on Oxford's research at ox.ac.uk/brain. Thanks for listening.